Justice Annette Kingsman Ziegler presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning. Alsop Venture Partners versus Murphy Desmond, 20 AP 806. Could I please have your appearances? All right, good morning. Good morning. All right. The lineup that I have is 25 minutes, followed by 30, and 5 minutes in rebuttal. Correct?
Correct.
All right. Proceed.
May it please the court. As I just said, my name is Scott Hessel, and I represent the petitioner plaintiffs, in this case, Terry and Sandy Shockley. Mr. Shockley is in the courtroom with us here today, along with my co-counsel. The trial court and court of appeals view of settlement evidence and superseded claims are as admissible without regard to a change in any witness's testimony or evidence of inconsistency is directly contrary to 904.08 and this court's admonitions about the prejudicial and inflammatory nature of the evidence. The lower court's holdings, if allowed to stand, will allow the exceptions to the admissibility of that evidence to swallow the rule. And the effect on Wisconsin proceedings going forward is to undermine the entire purpose by which we have 904.08, which is to encourage parties to settle cases. If the lower court's rulings are allowed to stand, that public purpose to encourage settlements will be undermined and parties will find the motivation to settle with some but not all parties deterred. There are four principal issues before the court. The first two, I think, are related, which are the wrongful admission of settlement evidence and its misuse in closing argument. The second concerns the superseded complaint, which was allowed to be admitted into evidence. And the third relates to the intentional indemnity cross-claim. On two of these issues, the Court of Appeals agreed that the trial court erred, but found, in our view, dubious ways to nonetheless affirm the verdict. Turning to the first two issues, which are the admission of settlement evidence and its improper use in closing argument. As set forth in 904.08, and as analyzed by this court most recently in Morden v. Continental, settlement evidence is generally inadmissible because of its incendiary nature and the high potential for prejudice. While the rules do allow for the possibility that it could be used for other purposes, such as witness bias or prejudice, Morden admonished trial courts that such exceptions should be narrowly construed. Here, there is and was no suggestion by Murphy Desmond, and there was no finding by the trial court that a single witness, the Shockleys or the settling defendants, change their testimony in any way due to the settlement. Indeed, the Shockleys testified at trial, as they had in depositions, that all of the professionals who represented them did so poorly. And indeed,
Mr. Hessel, what the trial court did find was that what changed as a result of the Perringer agreement was that the burden of proof changed, right? And I'm looking at page 12 of the motion in limine hearing where the Judge Neese talks about instead of having the burden of proof and actively looking to prove the case against the settling parties, they have settled those claims and are now playing a defense on those claims and will no doubt be arguing for a lesser percentage of causal negligence. And then he goes on and he says, that is clearly a change in the posture, the reversal of the burden or the transfer of the burden. And he goes on and talks about that being significantly different, which I believe is the language in in the
Morden.
Is that how we pronounce it, Morden?
Yeah.
In the Morden case.
Yeah. That is what the trial court found, and that is what Murphy Desmond argues in this case, that we changed our posture. But we did not, in order for the trial court's rationale for what constitutes a change in posture to meet the rule and Morden, it is not enough that the posture of parties changes, because any time there's a settlement, the posture of parties will change. We, having settled our claims against Curtis and RSM, were obviously not going to proceed to still put on the evidence of those claims. As to Murphy Desmond, though, which in our view is the relevant posture that should have been evaluated, not the question of whether the settled defendants still remain the case, the posture as to Murphy Desmond was unchanged from the start of the case till the trial of the case. In the original complaint, we alleged that they were lead counsel and therefore bore responsibility for the advice that they gave to our clients to go forward with the transaction. Those claims were unchanged as a result of settling.
What about the change, though, in the fact that there's no longer an tort being alleged against the settling parties? And isn't that significant here? Isn't that enough? Because you're not just saying they're all negligent and Murphy Desmond bore some of that responsibility. If someone was intentionally acting, if one of the parties was intentionally acting, it can affect indemnification. It affects all kinds of parts, and that is no longer, that was taken out of the amended complaint and taken out of the what was presented to the jury.
Well, while you're correct that when we settled our case against Curtis and RSM, all of the claims that we settled against them were dismissed, which is what happens anytime a plaintiff settles with some but not all parties. So respectfully, the trial court and appellate court's rationale and these arguments about change in posture being sufficient to warrant the admission of settlement evidence will apply to any circumstance where you admit. But I do want to make a point, which is that what Morden suggests, and it's consistent with the rule, is that the change in posture must come with evidence of bias or prejudice to a witness. It's not enough that the posture of the case has changed. There has to be something that connects the change in posture with a change in witness. After all, that is what the rule references,
well,
right?
Well, not quite. Are you talking about the statute?
Yeah, the statute says...
If you read it, it says, first of all, it says such as. So this section does not require exclusion when the evidence is offered for another purpose, such as proving bias or prejudice of a witness, negativing a contention of undue delay, proving a court in satisfaction, novation or release, or proving an effort to compromise or obstruct a criminal investigation or prosecution. So it's a list, right? Another purpose, such as?
Right. Well, I think what we have to go from is how this court dealt with that list in Morden, which is, we do have to be mindful of the fact that the general rule, not the exceptions, but the general rule is settlement evidence is inadmissible to prove the liability of a claim or the viability of the claim. There are other purposes where it could be admissible, but they have to be connected to one of those other purposes. And the witness prejudice or bias is only connected to a change in posture if the change in posture resulted in some evidence of witness bias and prejudice.
I'm just not reading it the way you are. That sentence says...
Or.
Yeah.
The sentence says, or.
It says the party may demonstrate prejudice or bias by showing that a witness changed his or her testimony. Or.
Or, yes.
Okay, that the posture of the settling party was significantly different. Why do they have to be tied together?
Well, first, let me make a point about the posture change in this case. Murphy Desmond alleged a cross-claim of intentional indemnity and contribution as to those other defendants from day one in this case. So as to their burden of proof on the cross-claims of intentional wrongdoing and negligence of other parties, that didn't change. That was always their cross-claim. The plaintiffs alleged claims against other parties with whom they settled and then proceeded against Murphy Desmond in the same fashion we had since the outset of the case. Our posture as to the claims against Murphy Desmond were no different. We always alleged that there were multiple joint tortfeasors who bore liability. The witness, the Morden suggestion about there must be a significant change in posture, which is connected to the rule. It does say that there could be a change in posture, which perhaps in and of itself evidences witness bias. Let me give you an example. If we had settled with Curtis Millay and RSM and insisted that their witnesses cooperate with us in our pursuit of the claims against Murphy Desmond, got affidavits from those witnesses that changed their position in the case, or created a financial motivation to those settling defendants that said something like, which is not uncommon, you say, we'll settle with you for a certain amount, but if we get more money from the remaining defendant, we'll reduce the amount that we have against you. None of that is what transpired here. The only thing that transpired is that we settled claims that we once had in the case. This is also not a situation which you find in some of these cases where we didn't allege claims against Murphy Desmond from the outset of the case. The claims against Murphy Desmond were unchanged. The posture as between the plaintiff and Murphy Desmond were unchanged.
Counsel, would you address the standard of review and what work you see it doing for you here? The Court of Appeals reviewed this for an erroneous exercise of discretion, talked about the discretion that's given to the trial courts here. We're going to defer to the findings of the trial court, said this was a reasonable decision. The arguments that you're making strike me as very much in the nature of asking us to go back and reread the evidence and come up with our own views on it, rather than doing what an appellate court does, which is not reinvent the wheel, but determine whether the decision in this case was made within the bounds of the law. So talk to me about how the standard of review operates in your analysis.
Yeah, I think the end of that question is exactly the issue that we have before us, which is, did the trial court act within the bounds of the law as to the admissibility of settlement evidence and the superseded complaint? It dealt with the background of Morden as well as Bruss, which were two Supreme Court decisions that were directly on all fours with the facts of this case. You had in Morden multiple defendants originally alleged, settling with some but not all, and the trial court and then this court affirming the determination that the nature of the case against the remaining defendant in Morden, just as the nature of the case here, did not change and did not result in triggering one of the exceptions. So I think the question for this court is either the circumstances that this defendant has raised, which are you settled with some but not all, we have an evidence that any witness changed their testimony, but we nonetheless can cross-examine your witnesses on those settled claims and settlement evidence, can be reconciled with this court's precedent in Morden. I would submit that there's nothing that factually distinguishes our case from that case. And more significantly, I think, is do we want to reaffirm the admonition that Morden gave to trial courts, which is that those exceptions to the rule where settlement evidence should be allowed need to be narrowly construed?
Counsel, looking at the standard of review in Morden, Morden says that this court has, quote, the inherent and express authority to review requests for a new trial independently. So we don't have to do it as whether it was an erroneous exercise of discretion if we think that justice has for any reason miscarried. Isn't that what Morden says?
It does, and I think I would go one step further, which is that what Morden suggests in that footnote citing this law review article, and I think all of us appreciate, which is settlement evidence really is incendiary. It really does have a very high potential for prejudice. No matter what we tell juries about that there were no admissions of liability and you should only consider it for a limited purpose, the normal person, probably a lot of the students in this courtroom, would react to the presentation of settlement evidence by viewing it as the party who settled probably did so for a reason. And we have to be mindful of that, which is why the rule is what it is. We don't want to allow it except for narrow circumstances where it might suggest prejudice or bias. And has the defendant in this case suggested anything to that effect? They questioned our witnesses in depositions. The witnesses actually had given testimony in tax court beforehand, and they blamed all of these defendants. There was no inconsistency from the start of the case to the settlement of the case. It could be that a witness would get up and say, oh, yes, now I'm only pointing the finger at Murphy Desmond because I've settled my claims against those other defendants. But that's not what transpired here, and that's not what the trial court exercised its discretion to make a finding of fact on which you all could rely. Instead, it suggested that merely because we dismissed claims, that the posture against this defendant warrants the admission of settlement evidence. But how is that different from any case where you settle claims? Because from as best as I can tell, Morden, and there are other cases, do require a change in testimony. If there hasn't been a change in testimony, then it doesn't connect to the rule.
What about the change in testimony from accusing other parties of intentional conduct initially and now kind of sterilizing the facts to no longer be accusing them of intentional conduct? And to me, that might be the distinguishing factor here. So can you address that?
Sure. If that's what had transpired, I would suggest that maybe they could prove that. But what happened here is that we alleged claims against Murphy Desmond arising out of them being the lead counsel on this transaction, as well as other claims against other parties. Those claims were settled and dismissed. The witnesses did not say at trial, oh, RSM and Curtis, they didn't do anything wrong. The witnesses didn't say that RSM and Curtis didn't lie to us. They didn't refute.
I don't think that's what, at least what I understand, Justice Dallet wanting you to respond to. Did you make a claim for intentional conduct against Murphy Desmond early on?
No.
Not Murphy
no.
Desmond. No, that's
okay.
Not what I was asking.
Oh.
So, yes, thank you, though. I appreciate it.
As to the original parties, there's no question that we had alternative claims for intentional wrongdoing.
So you think their testimony at trial was consistent with claims of intentional conduct against the parties that were dismissed?
Well, what I would say is that there's no question that we did not put on evidence of intentional wrongdoing as to parties with whom we settled, which is exactly what Morden said, right? Morden involved a situation where the expert witness by the plaintiff was no longer giving opinions as to the party Volkswagen with whom they settled. And the defendant, who remained, the tire manufacturer, said, wait a minute, this expert previously said that Volkswagen was negligent. They have to put on that testimony at trial. But that can't be the rule, because anytime you settle with a party, you no longer put on that evidence at trial. And as to Murphy Desmond, I think it's important to remind the court that the posture of the case that was presented at trial was that they alone bore the burden of proof on their cross-claims against those remaining parties. We bore the burden of proof to prove that they were negligent.
Counsel, can I ask about your second issue, the superseded pleadings question? In your opening brief, you argue that the superseded pleadings are not admissible. That's the general rule is they're not admissible unless they're inconsistent with the operative pleadings. And then Murphy Desmond says, no, that's not right. They're actually authorized admissions and therefore admissible. And you come back in your reply brief and say, well, operative pleadings are binding, superseded pleadings are not, and superseded pleadings are just subject to normal rules of evidence. Your position in the reply brief seems to be inconsistent with the position you took in your opening brief with regarding to the general rule. Are they subject to the normal rules of evidence? Is the rule that they're not admissible unless they're inconsistent? So I'm interested in your position on that. Anything else you want to say about, authorized admissions as well?
Yeah, I think to the extent that there was confusion there, I think the position that we argued from the get-go was based on Bruss as well as this court's decision in Rood, which is a little bit older, the general presumption should be superseded completes are a nullity and not admissible as evidence unless they present an inconsistency. Murphy Desmond came back and said, well, wait a minute. You filed a complaint, and it's a binding admission because the lawyers who filed the complaint on your behalf were your agents, and it's a party admission, to which we say that doesn't answer the issue that is presented by Bruss and Rood, which is, should superseded complaints, even if they are a binding admission of the party, be admitted at trial? And those courts suggest that they should not, unless there's an inconsistency for good reason, which is, again, like settlement evidence, unverified, unsigned, and superseded complaints have a high potential for prejudice.
Okay, I just want to dive into that a little bit. Yeah. Here. I want to understand your position. Because in your reply brief on page 7, you say the superseded complaint is like any other evidence, and its admissibility depends on the applicable evidentiary rules. So are you arguing that we applied normal evidentiary rules, which would include, of course, probative value and prejudice and all that kind of stuff, normal evidence stuff? Or are you arguing there's a unique rule applicable that we've announced that's applicable to superseded pleadings that they can't be admitted unless they're inconsistent? I just want to understand what you're asking us to...
I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's that in order, because of the high potential for prejudice as to a superseded complaint, we require that it establish inconsistency. It's not enough that it was filed on our behalf. Those party admission cases concern whether it's hearsay or not. We don't deny that it meets a non-hearsay exception. We just think that that is a different question of whether it should be admitted at trial. And the question of whether it should be admitted at trial gets into if there is a inconsistency between the complaint which has now been superseded and what you're now operating on, then there's a basis for its admission. If there's not, then it should be generally excluded subject to some other rationale.
And is that just under our normal weighing? A balancing test? Is that what you're arguing, that the prejudicial effect is greater than the...
Well, I think that's what Bruss and Rood are foundational, where the foundation for the inconsistency comes from, which is unless there's an inconsistency, we worry about the potential prejudicial effects versus its probative value. After all...
A non-hearsay exception is different from a non-hearsay exclusion is different from an exception to hearsay. Can you clarify for me which you meant? I thought you were saying this was excluded from being considered hearsay because of its character as this particular document and the purpose for which it would be admitted. Now you're talking exceptions.
What I was addressing was Murphy Desmond's position is they cite the cases that say, wait a minute, this was a party admission, a non-hearsay party admission, so it should be admissible. And we say that those cases about it being an admission are about whether it's hearsay or not, not about whether it is admissible or relevant to the case at hand. Bruss and Rood address that second question. No one's denying that it might be not hearsay or within the exception for party admissions, but the more difficult question which Rood and Bruss address is we don't want it to be admitted in evidence because of its highly prejudicial nature unless it reflects inconsistency. And there's a good reason for that, which is that allegations, especially early in a case, are not evidence. But when used in the fashion that they were, and I do want to, I see my time is coming up, used in the fashion that they were, which is from the opening statement to the cross-examination of both the plaintiffs to the start of the closing argument, the central focus of the defense in this case was not about the actual evidence of intentional wrongdoing by these other parties, but about the fact that we had previously alleged claims against them and then settled the case. And it went even further than that in closing argument, in direct contravention of the rule, when Mr. Johnson argued to the jury that the enormous amount of money that the Shockleys had received.
Can we talk about that? Because I thought it was Mr. Shockley's attorney who introduced the amounts at trial, and I'm interested in how that should play into our analysis.
Yeah, I was pretty shocked that Murphy Desmond suggested in their brief that they had not known of the settlement amount until the trial of the case, because at the same time that Murphy Desmond moved pre-trial for the admission of settlement evidence, they also moved to compel and were granted a motion to compel disclosure of the net settlement amount. And so we had every reason to believe that based on their efforts to compel that evidence and to get the trial court to allow them to use that evidence, that they would introduce it at trial.
There was a trial court ruling to that effect, allowing the disclosure of the amounts of the settlement.
In I would refer you to the record at 242, and 241, which was their motions. If I see my light has come on, but can I answer this question?
Yes, you may finish the answer.
Yeah, at record sites 241 and 242, they moved to compel the net settlement amount. We objected and said it was subject to confidentiality restrictions, and the trial court issued an order compelling their disclosure. That's in the transcript that they cite, 464. It's just in the portion after their cite in their brief.
And Justice, can I just ask if that was pretrial or during trial, the ruling?
It was pretrial. And
yes, I guess you
can. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're done now. You can sit down.
I may have gotten you in trouble. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Just try to make it even on both sides. That's why I try to stick to it. So it's not unfair, and one side gets more time than the other.
May it please the Court. As you already know, my name is Terry Johnson. I have the privilege of appearing before you to represent the defendant's respondents, Murphy Desmond, Robert Pash, and their insurance carrier. I'd like to start out by emphasizing one point which I think tends to get lost in the shuffle. If the plaintiffs had not voluntarily entered into the Perringer settlement that they entered into, and the same verdict had been returned, they would have recovered every penny of their damages. The reason they are not recovering every penny of their damages is not because of the way the trial was conducted, but because they made the decision to enter into a Perringer release with the defendants who had the most liability in the cases.
Counsel, isn't that the way it happens on many occasions?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, okay. On some occasions, then, let me...
On an extremely small number of occasions for two reasons. First of all, cases in which there are joint tortfeasors, some of whom are intentional tortfeasors and some of whom are negligent tortfeasors, are exceedingly rare. Of course they are. I mean, this is an unusual situation, to say the least. And second of all, most of the time, plaintiffs don't settle on Perringer bases with the major defendants. They settle with the marginal defendants, which is why the rule under Morden doesn't come into play very much. Because Morden says you have to demonstrate either a change in testimony of a witness, which we acknowledge did not occur here, or there has to be a significant change in the posture of the party. And, of course, despite all the boogeyman arguments by Mr. Hessel, when you only have a minor defendant who settles out on a Perringer basis in the case, there isn't likely to be a significant change in position. When you have a significant change in position is when the Perringer settlement has the potential impact of destroying your case. And when the Perringer has the potential for destroying your case, then you have significant changes in impact. And what we are doing here today, again, with Mr. Hessel, is the same thing he tried to do with the jury, the same thing he tried to do with the court on motions after verdict, and the same thing he tried to do with the Court of Appeals. And that's say, all we did is not present expert testimony against these people. Everything else stayed the same. I didn't change my position at all because of the Perringer. And I'm sorry, just not true.
I'm thinking of the many, many, many cases that I've tried. I can't think of a single time that a settlement agreement has come in. I mean, in the federal system, of course, you might allow agreements because they go to a witness's credibility. That's a whole different thing in a criminal setting, right? But in a civil case, I'm trying to think of a single time evidence of settlement was allowed in.
This is not the first time it's happened with me. I guess I would fault the defense attorneys who handled the cases in front of you to some extent. But in addition, they weren't like this case. And let me demonstrate why this is not like this case. It's because of this. What Morton says is that it gets in if there is the posture of the settling party was significantly different as a result of the settlement. Not different, not slightly different, significantly different. And what does the posture of the settling party mean? It means more than the testimony of the witnesses. If it only meant the testimony of the witnesses, there would be no need for the or in the second provision. It means how they presented their case.
So what exactly was this admitted for?
This was admitted by the court to show that they had changed their position. That's all.
But you're saying, I'm trying to look back at my notes on what you were saying this wasn't. You said it wasn't for the change of testimony of a witness.
Right. We have not alleged that they changed their testimony. But the overall posture of the case changed from night to day. And the examples, as outlined on page 19 of our brief, and one more, which is even more striking, are just overwhelming.
So getting back to exactly what this was admitted for, I'm going to write it down.
This was admitted for the purpose of demonstrating, under the rule adopted in Morton, that there was a motivation for the plaintiffs in this case to present their case differently. And that's one of the two prongs of Morton. In Morton, Morton says, if you change your testimony, you can then bring in testimony. I can ask the question, isn't it true the reason you're now testifying in this fashion is because you settled with other people and it's now to your financial advantage to have the existing defendants blamed? That's the proper question under Morton.
Mr. Johnson, when wouldn't it be admitted?
Because most of the time, plaintiffs are smart enough, as they were here, not to change their testimony. Which gets us to the second prong, which says if the posture of a party in the case has significantly changed as a result of the settlement, then the settlement can be entered into evidence to have the jury understand that significant change. Because, of course,
it was admitted because of the change in testimony of a witness.
No, it's changed because the whole posture of the case changed, Chief Justice. If you give me just one moment, I will tell you how it changed.
Yeah, you did 13 paragraphs out of their first pleadings in your closing. Is that how you thought it changed?
No. It changed because on opening statement, Mr. Hessel told the jury that neither McGladrey nor Curtis Millay had committed intentional torts. Before the settlement, they were alleging they committed intentional torts. After the settlement, he told the jury on opening statement they didn't. He told the jury all the blame should be placed on Murphy Desmond. Before the settlement, his position was all three sets of professional defendants were negligent, and two of them committed intentional torts. On opening statement, he flat out told the jury, it's cited in our brief, that all the blame should be on Murphy Desmond. On direct examination of witnesses, he never asked any questions on these subjects. He just ignored it. The Shockleys presented no expert testimony on these subjects. On cross-examination of multiple witnesses, counsel for the Shockleys downplayed the conduct of the settling defendants. And we've given three different examples in our brief on page 19 of places where they asked questions intended clearly to downplay the responsibility of the people they settled with. On cross-examination of the McGladrey and Curtis Millay witnesses, all of whom were deposed before trial, and their videotapes were shown to the jury, by leading questions, Mr. Hessel got them to say they made no misrepresentations. Now, how is that not a substantial change in position? If these are not substantial changes in position, what you should do is you should go get your copy of the Morton decision and cross that part out. Because if this is not a substantial change in position, there will never be one. On closing argument, he argued that the evidence didn't support any findings against McGladrey or Curtis Millay. And here's the better one. Before trial, they alleged, before the settlement, they claimed that McGladrey had committed a misrepresentation by failing to disclose the $1 million kickback they got if and only if the transaction they recommended, when they had no experience with transactions of this type, when they concealed and lied to the plaintiffs about the fact that they had no experience, telling them they had experience that they admitted they didn't have, they didn't tell them that, by the way, if we can convince you to go ahead with this deal, we get paid $1 million. when they took the depositions, they asked them to deny that they did that, and then they argued at trial that McGladrey had actually disclosed the kickback.
Counsel, this case, in my mind, has potential for, using the words of Morden, significant ramifications.
I don't think it does, and I don't think it does for lots of reasons.
Okay.
First of all, I have never...
Let me finish my question.
I'm sorry, I thought you were done. Apologize.
So, if you were to prevail, what is the narrowest way that the decision can be written in your favor? And I'm going to ask opposing counsel if I have an opportunity to also respond to that. And then you can fill in if you want on your...
First of all, I believe we should prevail on this issue, obviously. And if there's anything that needs to be done, it would only be to emphasize the fact that this case involves major revisions of the plaintiff's position. And that's what brings it in the rule of significantly different under the Morden language. There's no need for a new holding. It's simply to say, under Morden, if there is a significant change in the posture of the settling party, which is obviously because of the settlement. I mean, what other reason would there be to run away from these allegations? And this is one case where we find, as the trial court did, as the Court of Appeals did, that there's a significant change. It's a night and day change.
So let me put my words into your answer, because I'm looking how to have it a narrow decision. I might be wrong, but I'm looking to that, regardless of who wins. But your response was same thing as Morden. But my sense is that you're really saying, under the unique facts of this case, or under the facts of this case, make it fact-specific. Am I putting too many words in your mouth?
No, if I was writing the decision on this subject, I would say Morden recognizes that admission of a Perringer settlement is proper where the posture of the settling party was significantly different as a result of the settlement.
See, I have problems with that. When I was reading the Court of Appeals opinion, I put slippery slope when they talk about that, I guess it's in paragraph 29. I mean, they do say in the same paragraph that both parties here in some ways maybe it wasn't paragraph 29, it's paragraph 30. Both sides at trial took the position that the settling defendants did at least some wrong in connection with the Midco transaction. So it seems to me that it boils down to a determination of what's a significant change, and that's a pretty amorphous standard.
Actually, that's not true, because as I just demonstrated, both on opening statement and in closing argument, Mr. Hessel took the position that the settling defendants, according to the evidence, had done nothing wrong, that they were not guilty of intentional torts. So if I was writing the decision, with all due respect, that time you interrupted me, I would...
well, I don't know if that's
I would
the
say
that's due,
the rule recognized in Morden demonstrates that if the posture of a settling party was significantly different as a result of the settlement, the Perringer is admissible. In the exercise of discretion by the trial court under the standard of care that Justice Hagedorn referred to, this was appropriate because the following points demonstrate there was a significant change. And I would recite each of the points we cited on page 19 of our brief and the additional example on the supposed disclosure of the kickback.
Counsel, what should we make of your closing argument, which to me was almost 100% the use of the settlement? I mean, you specifically read off 13 paragraphs out of the first pleading saying, well, they didn't argue anything about that to you. You didn't hear them talk about these claims. So basically you relied on that document pretty much for your closing argument.
I don't think it's a fair characterization at all.
Well,
certainly
13 paragraphs out of the first pleadings you read. I can give you the numbers, but you know what they were.
I know I did that, but we talked about a lot of other things beyond that.
Not much. Paragraph-wise. Well, I don't know. I found it quite amazing when the rule says you're not to use settlement. Not to use settlement.
But the evidence was already admitted. It was admitted. And I abided by the court's ruling. I did not argue that the fact of the settlement, which is different, of course, than what was in the complaint, The fact of the settlement didn't mean that there was liability. What I did argue in one sentence, which I will tell you I believe to this day was totally proper, was their voluntary introduction of the amounts of the settlement was not within the scope of that ruling. It wasn't. It couldn't have been within the scope of the ruling because nobody knew anybody was going to be admitting evidence of the dollar amounts that they had been paid at the time the ruling was made, and the court didn't comment on it. The court simply said, here's how you can use the fact of the settlement. They then, to my astonishment, entered into the amounts that were received, and I commented on them. When I commented on them, there was no ruling whatsoever that said that commentary was improper. The court ruled on it, I stopped, and I went on. So, if I do not, people ask questions all the time during trials. People make statements during trials that judges find improper and sustain objections to. That's all that happened. There was no misconduct. There was nothing that happened other than taking proper advantage of a piece of evidence which they, for reasons I've never understood, elected to introduce voluntarily.
Now, the piece of evidence you took the most advantage of was the superseded complaint.
And why would I not?
Why? Because all it was relying on what someone else had said in a superseded pleading for liability. You were relying
no,
on
that
it
was
to
not
show
the purpose.
Liability. Well, it may not have been your purpose, but that's how it comes across when you read it.
You mistake my purpose, and let me make clear what my purpose was. From the beginning of this trial, Mr. Hessel played pretend with the jury. When he made his opening statement, he ignored the fact that these prior claims had been made, even though he knew they were going to get into evidence. He talked about the case as if there had never been allegations that they had done things wrong, and on closing argument, he took the position that these people, no claim had been proved against them when in fact they had. And what I was demonstrating to the jury was this. From the very beginning of the case, not because of changes in testimony, but because of the way the plaintiff's lawyer elected to present this case, they presented a pretend case. They pretended that there wasn't evidence to prove these people acted intentionally wrongfully. They pretended there wasn't evidence to prove they were negligent. They pretended they never claimed that. And we need to take into account the credibility of the posture of the case, which is the posture of the case only comes from the lawyers. It's the credibility of what they advanced. That's why I went into it, because I thought that was a terrible mistake on their part, and they need to be called on it.
So had they not filed a superseded complaint, even though there was a release as to those parties, do you agree that you would not have been able to go into any of this information about the settlement?
First of all, that wasn't the situation.
I know. I'm trying to understand, and I take it to this goes to Justice Anne Walsh Bradley's point, and I have concern as well about whether or not this exception is going to swallow the rule, whether Perringer releases their utility, their ability to be used without dredging in all of these all of this information that's going to be swallowed by depending on what we say and how we say it. So that's the context of which I'm asking the question.
But I just want to make clear. I wasn't dealing with a hypothetical of what would have happened if the thing was different. I was dealing with the case as it was tried.
I understand.
But if the pleading had not been amended, there would still have been an argument that it was admissible as a statement by a party.
Right.
And I could have argued it. I think my guess is from what Judge Neese said when he ruled on this question, if they had not amended the pleadings to eliminate the allegations against the settling defendants, he probably would have exercised his discretion not to permit it. It was a combination of the fact that it was an admissible admission on their part with the fact that they had changed their position that in his mind caused him to exercise his discretion to admit it.
But they changed their position because they had a Perringer release, right?
Correct.
That's why they changed it.
Correct.
And Perringer releases are very, very, very common.
Actually, they're not. They're very uncommon.
I've not been in practice for probably now 26 years, so you may be right. But when I was in practice for 16 years, they were fairly common.
And I think what happened over time is that plaintiff's lawyers learned that Perringers are very high-risk propositions, and so they stopped using a long time ago Perringer releases, except for the most marginal defendants, because of exactly this. What is far more common now, having just gone through it in a couple of my cases recently, is they'll settle with a marginal defendant, dismiss them, but not give them a release, give them a covenant not to sue. And because they are so marginal, the other defendants don't keep them in the case because there's no reason to. And that's because Perringers have risk.
So under the rules of evidence, are you going under a theory that is developed because of Morton, or are you going under a theory that your exception falls within one of the outline provisions?
As to the fact of the settlement, not the amount, because we never introduced evidence of the amount, as to the fact of the settlement, Morton says if there's a substantial, significant change in position and posture,
I know that's what Morton
that's said. That's the argument for the settlement.
I understand. But in Morton, Continental did not get to put in the evidence.
That's because the court in that case, exercising its discretion, applying the rule, concluded there wasn't a significant change in position.
I must be asking my questions inartfully. Which in the statute, not in Morton, but in the statute, 90408, are you relying on any of the provisions in the statute for the admissibility of that evidence? Or are you kind of saying there's this new category because of the such as?
I'm relying upon the concept that was advanced earlier in questions, and that is it says it can be introduced for a purpose, other purposes, and then it gives a such as set of examples. That list is not exhaustive. It's not intended to be. And Morton.
My question, is it anything in that list?
It's not specifically in that list. Rather, Morton identified an additional example that falls within the scope of the statute that permits admission.
In the context of a case where the settlement was not admitted. Right?
Correct. And in the context of saying if there is a significant change, it will be admitted. Again, if this is not a significant change, I cannot imagine what would be. The last issue is the one I'd just like to spend a couple of moments on in what time I have left, and that is the issue of the application of the Fleming rule on motions after verdict by the trial court to determine no recovery could be made, and its affirmation by the Court of Appeals. The question raised by the plaintiff on this subject matter area on appeal is a negligent tortfeasor entitled to indemnity from an intentional tortfeasor without proof of any connection between the intentional tortfeasor and subsequent negligence? Intentional wrongdoing and subsequent negligence. That's a fundamental mischaracterization of what the evidence showed in this case. And it needs to be understood in that context. The evidence in this case demonstrated, according to testimony in large part from the plaintiffs themselves, the Shockleys, that they entered into this transaction as a result of several different pieces of information they got from their professional advisors. One was the advice from McLadry that this was a good way to get around their practical problem of how best to sell the company, and that a Midco would be a transaction would work without telling them. They had no basis whatsoever to make that recommendation because they'd never done a Midco transaction, and without telling them they stood to earn $1 million if they could get the Shockleys to go ahead with it. The second was Curtis Millay telling them that they had the qualifications to pass upon this transaction without telling them they had no experience with Midco transactions at all. And then offering an opinion which purported to say that this transaction would withstand scrutiny by the IRS.
What are your best cases for this kind of evidence being admitted?
Which kind of evidence?
This evidence, the evidence, the fact of settlement.
I will tell you, if you affirm the Court of Appeals, I'm not going to be around that long, but if I was practicing for another 20 years, I would be astounded if anyone ever had another case where there was a negligent tortfeasor and two other tortfeasors who were intentional and negligent tortfeasors. The plaintiff settled with the intentional and negligent tortfeasors, and the question then came up whether they had changed their posture in the case sufficiently to admit it. This is such an unusual situation. As we said when we briefed the petition for review, this is an extremely important case for the litigants, and it has nothing to do with the long-term day-to-day administration of justice because it's so unusual.
My question was supposed to be more simple than that.
I guess inartfully asked, as all of our questions are today.
Okay. We'll see. A list of cases where settlements are admitted at trial and been upheld on appeal. That's what I'm looking for.
I could only cite you to the cases which are in the brief, which are small number of cases over a period of 60 years. This is really not an issue that comes up a lot. And the case is demonstrated.
Okay, so I'll just I need to look in your brief. You don't have those on the top of your head.
Well, it's the cases that are talked about are Morton.
No. Morton Continental was not allowed to admit the settlement evidence.
Well, yeah.
So I'm looking for cases where the evidence was admitted at the trial court and that was upheld on appeal.
I believe the case where it is admitted is Johnson versus Heinz, and that was on the basis of a change in testimony, if I recall correctly.
So they were impeaching a witness?
Correct. And again,
any other cases where settlement negotiations have been admitted anytime 60 years or more? Or?
Well, I can tell you there are many cases where settlement negotiations have been admitted, but where it's been an issue on appeal, no, I cannot identify any others other than their brief. And most of those cases, the court was upholding the exclusion of evidence.
Right. I think that's
but again,
typically how that comes out.
I don't think any of those cases actually represent an effort by an appellant or a respondent to justify the admission of evidence on the basis that there had been a significant change in the posture of a party as a result of the settlement, which is one of the two grounds recognized in Morton. That's exactly what happened here, and Judge Neese followed exactly the procedure of looking at the rule and saying, is there evidence here of a substantial change in position? And as we point out in our brief, if he hadn't made that ruling in advance of trial, which actually gave the plaintiffs the right to try to minimize the impact of that as best they could, he would have had to have made it at trial after the plaintiff did all the things that we mentioned, because by that time, exactly what Judge Neese contemplated was inevitably going to happen had happened. They had gone away from saying a significant part of the liability here rests with people who committed intentional torts and were negligent and led them to enter into a transaction that they never would have entered into otherwise, with the negligence on the part of Murphy Desmond being, in large part, I think, under the evidence, you didn't catch them and warn us not to trust these people. You didn't warn us that there were signs that what they were telling you were true, that were not true, and you should have warned us about that. So these things are tied inextricably. And at trial, they took the position, in essence, that although there was some testimony about it, nothing was proved. None of those things were true. And the jury rejected it because, of course, it was proved. Those things were true. They did lie to them.
Counsel, you started to talk about indemnity, and I have some questions for you with respect to that issue, if you're done, Chief Justice. The verdict form is somewhat indecipherable for me. And if I were a jury, I can't imagine what was in the jury's minds because of the separate questions with respect to intentional misrepresentations and negligence. And the trial court acknowledged that it erred in submitting separate damages questions on the intentional torts of RSM and Curtis Millay. And I think this relates to your argument on indemnity, because on the other side, we have the argument that under IMARC, a negligent party seeking indemnity must show that the intentional conduct caused or contributed to that party's negligence. And in your brief, you say, of course, that is exactly what the verdict established in this case. That might be one way of reading the verdict, but the verdict doesn't say that at all. It does not. I know the circuit court or the trial court said this, that the the damages attributable to the intentional misrepresentations was a subset of the total damages, but that's not how the verdict form was presented. So could you address how you think the verdict establishes that the intentional conduct caused any negligent conduct?
I do not believe either IMARC or Fleming require a demonstration that the intentional conduct caused the negligent conduct. What IMARC at least hints at is that they have to be jointly operating. They both have to have some effect. And that's exactly what the verdict asked. Questions 14, 15, and 16 asked about damages caused by the Midco transaction. Those are the questions that deal with whether there were intentional misrepresentations. And that was the issue that was presented. In order to understand this, you have to understand what the damages claimed in this case were. The damages that the plaintiffs claimed were that as a result of the intentional misconduct of the two other different sets of defendants and their negligence and the negligence of Murphy Desmond, they entered into a potentially tax-advantaged transaction that they never would have entered into otherwise. And the damages that they sustained because they entered into that transaction by believing the misrepresentations and by accepting the negligent advice of these three sets of professionals were that they had to pay taxes, interest, and penalties they never would have had to pay, and that they incurred attorney's fees in attempting to contest the tax assessment. There are no other damages claimed in the case. There is no, even if one accepts the idea that IMARC seems to be saying that in IMARC, there was the potential that there were some damages only caused by negligent conduct and which were, could not be causally connected to the intentional conduct, there were no such damages here. The damages were caused by a combination, according to the jury's finding, and I think the overwhelming evidence before the court, a combination of believing McGladrey and Curtis Millay were qualified to give the advice they gave when they weren't because they lied about their qualifications, of believing you could trust McGladrey to make those representations because they concealed the million-dollar kickback, and because the advice they gave on the qualification of these transactions was negligent because these transactions were not, this transaction was not likely to be accepted by the tax authorities.
But
the reason for the second set of questions is that the court, trial court erred, as it admitted later, when the plaintiffs suggested when the verdict was all worked out. If you read the record, the verdict was all worked out. It was agreed upon. The additional questions at the end were not going to be included. And then they suggested to the court that maybe the jury could parse out some element of damages that weren't causally connected to the negligence. And so the court put it in. And I objected to it and said it was a mistake at the time. And the court later agreed that there was no way to parse out those damages. So those findings were essentially irrelevant.
I'm confused because I'm reading from the transcript and the trial court said neither party requested the questions. They were included at the court's suggestion on the off chance that there was some basis in the record for the jury to conclude that some of the plaintiff's damages were caused by the negligence.
That is a misrecollection on the part of Judge Neese. If you go back and look at the proceedings on verdict and instructions, the plaintiffs raised the question. The judge asked me whether we agreed with it or not. I said they were unnecessary. They are a disguised form of attempting a comparison of responsibility between the parties because there is no differentiation among the damages, and the court elected to put them in anyway.
The verdict form is a bit confusing. I mean, if I were a juror, I'd be really confused about am I assigning a separate set of damages to negligence and a separate set of damages attributable to intentional conduct?
I think the evidence combined with, if I can finish the answer to this question.
May.
The evidence combined with the answers to the verdict make it clear the jury wasn't confused for this reason. If you accept the position the plaintiffs have argued, which is these are additional damages, not part of the principal set of damages, the damages add up to approximately $61.8 million. There is no basis whatsoever to say the damages in this case were $61.8 million. I can't remember the exact number, but the highest number that could be argued was about $44, $46 million. If you look at instead the damages that were awarded to Mr. Shockley individually, Mrs. Shockley individually, and their company individually, and compare them to the separate amounts, those separate amounts are approximately 80% of the figures that were awarded for all the damages resulting from the Midco transaction. And what those figures therefore represent is an effort to say, in a way that was improper, because you can't do this under the case law from this court, that most of the responsibility for the damages that were sustained were attributable to the intentional torts. But it's a meaningless finding because there is no basis to compare negligence and intentional torts, which is why the verdict doesn't do that. But they have to be a subset of the damages awarded in the initial set of questions, because otherwise the jury awarded $15 to $17 million more than the evidence in the case could possibly sustain.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with the issue of whether this case is somehow so unusual that the precedent of the appellate court and the trial court won't really have a profound rattle effect. While I was sitting there, I noted that if you just look at the factual scenarios of the cases that have actually been cited to this court, it gives you a host of scenarios where circumstances just like this happen all the time. You have DUI cases where you have an intentional wrongdoer who killed somebody, and you have additional claims against the party who provided the alcohol, who provided the car, who allowed them to drink. You have a gun case, which is like Imark or Fleming, where you have somebody who shoots. They get sued, as well as the person who provided the gun or the bullets or failed to supervise. All sorts of personal injury cases involve claims of intentional wrongdoing against one tortfeasor and negligent wrongdoing as to another. And merely because the plaintiff settles with the intentional wrongdoer, which happens all the time because that party may have limited resources and limited insurance, and then goes on as to the other parties who has more insurance, only has claims of negligence, does not warrant the admission of the settlement agreement with the intentional tortfeasor. If it does, then the exception means nothing. And I thought the Chief Justice's focus on the language of the rule is a good place to start. It says limited purposes for which it could be admitted, which is tied to witness bias or prejudice. Mr. Johnson admitted, as he did in the trial court, that there was no evidence of change of a single witness's testimony as a result of the settlement. With that fact, you cannot conclude that it somehow nonetheless gets into the exception, which is tied to witness bias and prejudice.
Counsel, admittedly, you have witness bias and prejudice shown by looking at the change in posture also.
Agreed that Morden says or change in posture, but it is in the context of a ruling that nonetheless excludes settlement evidence in a factual scenario which is identical to this one. The plaintiff originally sued VW because the car was not properly designed, and the tire manufacturer because that's why the defect occurred. They settled with VW. They had an expert who had testified as to all of the parties. They decided not to put on the expert as to the party who they settled with, and the trial court properly excluded, and this court affirmed, the exclusion of the settlement evidence. In the beginning of the case, they were blaming multiple parties, just like we did. At the end of the case, they only put on evidence as to the parties that they had not settled with, which happens in every case where you have a settlement with some but not all parties. Additional scenarios, and what I want to point out...
I'm curious as to what your response is as far as the indemnification issue is concerned. And my question for you, just want to make sure you touch on it before you sit down. What I'm interested in is whether or not there's any evidence that you could point me to that would show that Murphy Desmond's conduct was independently negligent.
So I think in my view of Imark and what we argue in the briefs, our position is that to prove a cross-claim, they must tie the intentional wrongdoing to their own negligence, in the absence of which the defendant acknowledges there was no evidence of. There was no evidence that merely because Curtis and RSM overstated their qualifications or failed to disclose the referral fee, that that somehow caused Murphy Desmond to fail to explain the risks of the transactions. In the absence of any evidence that there's a connection between intentional wrongdoing and the negligent tortfeasor, indemnity should not exist. Because Imark, the situation that was faced with the court was insiders who make misrepresentations to the accountant, and the accountant had to prove that those misrepresentations was why he was negligent at trial. They had to not only answer that question, but they also had to remand to determine whether the damages were entirely overlapping. On that issue, I think we do agree that there wasn't evidence about splitting up of the damages, but that is a sidestep from the issue we think about IMARC. I did just want to make one more point about the narrowest basis on which to decide this case, and to me, that's the closing argument. Because no matter what we want to say about Morden or whether we changed our... I'd like to just finish my sentence, if that's
you
okay.
You may. Mr. Johnson had ample opportunity to do the same.
You can't argue to the jury in the beginning of your opening statement that the settlement proves who the true culprits are and that the settlement is an acknowledgement of the allegations. That wasn't allowed by the limiting instruction. It's not allowed by the rule. And it's not allowed under Morden. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for interesting oral argument this morning. Second oral argument.